Good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and distinguished guests. Thank you for being here. Thank you all for joining us on the third public meeting of the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. If I could, three housekeeping items before we get started. We've got fire exits, safety first. Please be aware we are recording this session. And third, if you could please silence your phones, that'd be appreciated. To get started now, my name is Sean Skelly. I'm one of the 11 appointed commissioners of the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. I'll be emceeing the first part of tonight's meeting. Along with my fellow commissioners, I'd like to welcome you and to our meeting and say thank you very much for having us here in Nashville. We're very excited to be here. Also like to say happy Public Service Recognition Week to those who are serving. It's an honor for us to be here during this time. Before we begin, I'd like to take the time to thank everyone who has helped us in our visit here and all of us who served through the federal, state, and local government. National Public Service Recognition Week is all about recognizing and showing appreciation to the millions of government employees and military personnel who dedicate themselves and their careers to helping others. We're going to begin tonight with three guest speakers and an overview of the commission before we get to the public comments. We want to hear from you and begin a conversation about service tonight. On your chairs, you should find a card that you'll be able to use to share any thoughts that you have with us. If you choose to speak, you can also fill out a card or you can just fill out a card. But I'd also directly encourage you to visit our website at inspiretoserve.gov, and all comments there are taken aboard by our staff, and we read them every month as they come in. And please feel free to join us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook with the hashtag #InspireToServe. So to kick off our meeting, I'd like to introduce you to someone you should all know. The commission has had the honor from learning from the mayor earlier today, Mayor Jim Donches. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to welcome you all here to City Hall and thank the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service for visiting us here in Nashua. It's been interesting to meet and get to know a little bit the members of the commission and the staff, and we really appreciate your visit. Because whether it's locally or nationally, public service is a great way to make a positive impact here in Nashua or elsewhere around the country or in any community. And one of the reasons that I'm very proud to be mayor here in Nashua is that we have many volunteers who contribute in many different ways in many organizations. As an example, the commission met this morning at the community center with people that are helping us put on the Safe Stations program to combat the opioid epidemic. And we had people from NFR, National Fire Rescue, AMR, the ambulance company, as well as public health, and of course Harbor Homes and the Partnership for Successful Living, all of whom, and Revive Recovery, all of whom are working together to make that program a success and reduce opioid incidents here in Nashua. And a fine example of public servants and many volunteers working together to achieve a very positive result. Now, I apologize for the fact that after I finish speaking here, I have to go to a volunteer event, which is the 11th Annual International Sculpture Symposium, which is out at the airport. This is put on entirely by volunteers. We bring three sculptors in from around the world, and they do a work which is set up and displayed at a location in Nashua. So I do have to leave in just a moment to make sure that event goes as it's supposed to. But just like we're seeing nationally, and this is a pitch for our boards and commissions, Nashua still has volunteer positions to fill because we have vacant seats on boards, committees, and commissions. So if anyone here or who may be watching is interested in volunteering, please reach out to us and we can find a place for you in order to help us with many, many different things that are available. Anyway, thank you to the chair, Joseph Heck, and the other members of the commission for visiting, and we hope you've enjoyed it and at least learned a little bit from what we're doing in Nashville.
Thank you, Mayor. Before you run off, if I could, on behalf of the entire commission, I'd like to express our appreciation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mayor Donches. Next, we're very pleased to have with us Ms. Jen McCormick, Director of the Nashua Public Library. Jen began her position in the Nashua Public Library in January of 2010 and was previously Director of the Tewksbury Public Library in Massachusetts. During her years in the library profession, she served as Assistant Director, Reference Librarian at the Amesbury Mass Public Library, worked at the Phillips Exeter Academy and Seabrook Libraries. Ms. McCormick received her master's degree in library and information science from Simmons College and a bachelor's degree in history from the University of New Hampshire. Ms. McCormick.
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, really an honor. And personally, I find it encouraging that the public library was asked to talk about this. Professionally, it's nice to know that people are recognizing libraries for our contributions and for the amazing staff that we have. I'm sure everybody here is really familiar with the very traditional aspects of library service. So we still loan books, we still have story times, we have regular programming, we have professional reference librarians who will help you with your research, and you can come use our computers or our Wi-Fi. We still do all of that, and libraries across the country still do all of that, but more importantly, public libraries in communities like Nashua serve as service hubs for the community. We have partnerships with community organizations that will allow us to build personal relationships with them. They are allowed to use, we welcome them to use our space. And those personal relationships, those partnerships, allow us to connect residents, our customers, with the services that are available to them. The partnerships take a variety of different shapes. So one good example is USCIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services, have quarterly office hours in the library to help people be a little more comfortable with the naturalization process. The last time they were there, they had 12 people in talking, asking questions, getting an idea of what to expect for their citizenship interview, helping them make appointments. We have quarterly immunization clinics in our meeting rooms hosted by the Public Health Department. We do those at the same time as the USCIS meetings because if you want to become a citizen, you have to have current immunizations. That partnership is expanded, so now there are nursing students from Riviera University in the library every Wednesday offering health education to our customers. We're the biggest free tax help site in the state for the AARP volunteers. I think this year they did over 1,300 returns for low-income residents between February 1st and April 15th. And while people are there getting free tax help, they also get introduced to library services that they may not have known existed. Another way our partnerships are manifested is the participation by library staff in boards and commissions and committees throughout the city. I'm on the executive board of the My Brother's Keeper Initiative. My assistant director serves on the Community Connections Committee. A member of our staff is on the executive board of Great American Downtown. So in all that way, our staff makes connections with services that we can then connect our customers to. There's a lot of great stories that come out of this. I just want to share a couple of them briefly. Good example of a connection inside the library is a young man, 19 or so, is using our library on a regular basis, almost every day, hanging out with his friends, using the Wi-Fi, had a lot of interactions with our security staff for kind of being obnoxious. He didn't have enough to do. He showed up drunk one time. He was on a road to, sorry, you have to leave. You know, you can't keep coming. But our security guard knew that the recruiter from Job Corps was in the library every Thursday afternoon. And he'd spoken to her about this young man and made an appointment. So he was able to make that connection. The young man was accepted into the program and is now living at the facility in Concord and learning a trade. That's a really powerful connection that we were able to make. Another connection from our partnership with the school district happened earlier this spring when our teen librarian saw a young woman having an interaction that made her very uncomfortable with some people at the library that she didn't really belong with. They were not her peer group. So she had a little conversation. Turns out the young lady had been kicked out of her house and had nowhere to live. And the people she were talking to had actually been helping her. But Ashley was able to make a personal phone call to the homeless outreach worker in the school district and start the process of getting this young woman a place to stay. And because she's fabulous and a great public servant, Ashley actually walked with her to the shelter that had accepted her. So those are just a couple of examples. There are examples like that all over the country. I know a woman I met who works in Palo Alto who's working with the fire department. He's working on code violations in the homes of elderly people, low-income people, and he's invited the library to partner with them to offer other services to them. I have a little note here that I also was going to talk about the supervised visits that happen in the library and the great transformations that we've seen in families. So these partnerships that we have and all the activity invites, it has another great result. So if you're in our library and you're doing one thing, there is so much happening in our library, you get connected to other things happening. There are groups meeting, working on meeting community goals, solving community problems. If you looked at our calendar, our online calendar, it reads like a snapshot of what the citizens of Nashua are concerned about and what they're working on. Last year, our meeting rooms were used by outside groups, not the library group, over 2,000 times. That's a pretty powerful invitation for people to be involved in the city. I talked to a woman who came in for a knitting group. She saw the posters for the League of Women Voters candidate forums they were having, and she was thrilled beyond belief. It helped her learn about the election, and I think she got involved in the group. I think the other, I had another good story, but I think I'll skip it. So the library staff in Nashua and in libraries all across the country, because public libraries everywhere are doing similar things. They're really great examples of people, talented people, skilled people, using their education, using their skills to serve the communities they live in, rather than pursue a job in private industry. And we don't do it for the high salary, and we don't do it for public recognition. We do it because we know that libraries transform lives, and we consider it a privilege to be part of that transformation. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Jen. Next, we're excited to welcome Mr. Matt Wilhelm, Director of Old Soul Alliance Incorporated. Mr. Wilhelm grew up in Nashua, moved to Manchester after college to serve two terms as an AmeriCorps member with City Year New Hampshire, where he led a full-time team of tutors, mentors, and role models in high-need, under-resourced public schools. Mr. Wilhelm went on to join the founding teams of Serve Next, Calling All Crows, and the Old Soul Foundation, where he currently leads the development of Concert Corps, a national service pilot launching later this month in partnership with three music industry nonprofits. He's a past recipient of the Clinton National Service Innovation Award, the Spirit of New Hampshire Award for National Service, and the Thrivent National Volunteer Service Award. Mr. Matt Wilhelm.
First off, I want to thank the commission for coming here to New Hampshire, specifically to Nashua, where I grew up. And I want to welcome Commissioner Casey home to New Hampshire. Glad to have you back. You know, we have our lakes and our mountains, our quaint downtowns like the one here in Nashua. We have 18 miles of gorgeous coastline, but far and away, I firmly believe that New Hampshire's greatest natural resource is us, its people. I grew up here in Nashua, and after college, I moved to Manchester for City Year. I fell in love three times that year. First was with my wife, who was also serving as an AmeriCorps member with City Year. Second, I fell in love with the city of Manchester, which Jody and I now call home. And third, I fell in love with the big idea of voluntary national service and its power to transform our communities and our country. And the vision of a day when one day the most commonly asked question of a young person would be where and what did they do to make a difference during their service here. Just weeks after my second year of service in the summer heat of the 2008 First in the Nation presidential primary, I was here at City Hall, just out on the steps, the front steps, to introduce U.S. Senator and returned Peace Corps volunteer Chris Dodd as he unveiled his plan to grow AmeriCorps to 1 million members every year. And it was the most ambitious national service plan of that particular campaign cycle, but by no means the only one. A total of 11 candidates, including candidates from both major parties, U.S. Senator, Vietnam War vet John McCain, then U.S. Senator, and future President Barack Obama. They all signed a pledge being circulated by grassroots supporters of Serve Next New Hampshire to expand AmeriCorps by at least 100,000 members annually. That demonstration of support helped to lay the groundwork for the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act, bipartisan legislation that was signed into law by President Obama just months into his first term. But in so many ways, the Serve America Act was and is still symbolic for the incredible promise yet unrealized potential of the national service movement. Following 9/11 and then again after President Obama's inauguration, interest in and application to AmeriCorps was up. Yet federal investment remained stagnant and at times continues to be threatened. And maybe I'm biased, but I honestly can't think of a smarter investment than national service. We need to do more, we need to do better, and in order to achieve that one day vision of service being a common expectation and really a badge of honor, we also need to do things a little bit differently. After our AmeriCorps service, Jody and I helped our friends, musician Chad Stokes of the band Dispatch and State Radio, and his partner, tour manager, and fellow AmeriCorps alumna, Sybil Gallagher, start Calling All Crows, which is an organization that partners with local nonprofits to organize pre-show community service projects for musicians and their fans while they're out on tour. Over the last decade, Calling All Crows has inspired at least 15 young people that we can count to do a service year of their own, and countless others incorporate service into their lives in their own communities. In 2011, Chad and his Dispatch bandmates, Brad Corrigan and Pete Francis, kicked off their summer tour with three sold-out shows at the Red Rocks Amphitheater in Colorado. And in the process, Dispatch and their fans raised and donated $100,000 to sponsor a team with City or Denver. Later in the tour, the band raised an additional $100,000 for Teach for America, as well as the United Way, to support education-focused volunteer programs. Now, I bring up Red Rocks because it's not only the most known and celebrated concert venue in the entire country, but also because, and some of you may know this, it was built by the hands of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the most popular program of the New Deal. It's a landmark. It's a living tribute to the men of the CCC who served and gained skills and left their country better than they found it, much like the AmeriCorps members that serve today. Now, Jody and I are no longer on the road due to our future AmeriCorps members that we have living in our house, Ben, age 5, Rosie, age 2. But we created the Old Soul Alliance 2 years ago as a vehicle to incubate new programs that would help advance the work of so many incredible organizations in the music industry that are now engaging bands and fans through service. And in just a couple weeks, we'll be launching Concert Corps, which is a full-time summer national service pilot in partnership with Calling All Crows and Reverb, which is another great organization that has deep roots in the live music scene. They green massive arena tours and stadium tours for bands like Zac Brown, Dave Matthews, Dead & Company, Maroon 5, Pink, and more. And inspired by the members of the CCC that built Red Rocks nearly 80 years ago, Concert Corps members will build capacity for our pilot partners in a variety of ways. They're going to train volunteers at concerts and festivals to run these water refill stations that are going to decrease the use of single-use water bottles that end up going to landfills. They're going to train volunteers at concerts and festivals to decrease instances of sexual violence and harassment at shows through bystander trainings. They're going to recruit volunteers for pre-show service projects like beach cleanups, meal packing events, and more, all aimed at leveraging live music to create positive social and environmental impact and exposing more young people to national and community service. Now, we need to market national service better and differently, and I also believe that we need to dig deeper than we are already to identify challenges that are facing communities that could effectively be addressed by deploying national service as a public policy solution. Just this past Friday, I was part of a convening that included representatives from Volunteer New Hampshire, our state commission, local CNCS staff, state leaders from both higher ed and senior services, who all came together to explore the possibility of creating a new service program that's aimed at helping New Hampshire's rapidly growing senior population safely age in place in their own communities and in their own homes, supported by a core of college-age students who are, you know, who we as a state are so focused on and desperately trying to keep them in the state and preventing a brain drain. Core members will help with non-medical services, including transportation, meal prep, home repairs, snow shoveling, light yard work. And I was thrilled to see so much enthusiasm across the different fields, across the different sectors, for a project that was going to incorporate AmeriCorps members, use services as a strategy. And we plan to apply for an AmeriCorps planning grant in the next few weeks. I'm also glad that New Hampshire is beginning to deploy services as a strategy to address the opioid crisis, to preserve our public lands, to keep kids in school and on track to graduate, to end poverty, and so much more. The longer I live here, the more I'm convinced that Granite Staters are just waiting to be asked to be served, just like Americans all over the country. We're connected like never before, yet studies show that we're as lonely and isolated as ever. Through service, whether we're talking about our armed forces, AmeriCorps, Senior Corps, Peace Corps, or municipal, state, federal government service, we don't have the option to unfriend or unfollow those with whom we're serving. There's no option to unplug or disconnect from one another. We're all in this thing together, regardless of race, gender, religion, socioeconomic status. You serve on some of the most diverse teams when you're in public service. Jody often says that when you have an experience of serving on a diverse AmeriCorps team, you're prepared to do absolutely anything else in your career. And I've experienced that to be true as well. Those of you among us who have or presently or will one day serve, you represent the very best of what America is and what our country aspires to be. You defend us, you roll up your sleeves to address community's toughest challenges, and you are the first to respond when our neighbors need you. And ultimately, I'm convinced that these same servant leaders will be the ones to save our democracy and our republic. Organizations like New Politics, founded by AmeriCorps alumna Emily Cherniak, are equipping military vets and National Service alumni with the skills they need to effectively write their next chapter in service as candidates for public office. And so think about that for a moment. Imagine if Congress or our state citizen legislature up in Concord had the majority of their seats filled by individuals who have had some sort of military, national, or public service background. Imagine how differently those bodies might operate than today, and how differently our conversations with our neighbors might be as well. Just imagine the experiences and shared values that these servant leaders would bring with them. Values of teamwork, empathy, open-mindedness, honesty, respect, courage, service above self. Imagine how servant leaders equipped with those kinds of values and previous service experiences would tackle our most pressing challenges. But in order to get to that moment, we need to grow our numbers so that voluntary national service is a common expectation for young people, truly. We need to expand opportunities for Americans to roll up their sleeves and to effectively deploy service as a people-powered, impact-driven solution whenever possible, whether tackling the opioid crisis, our state's silver tsunami, or educational inequity in our schools. I want to thank again the commission for coming to New Hampshire. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt. Next, I'd like to introduce my colleague and fellow commissioner, Mr. Alan Casey, to provide a brief overview of the commission. Alan is a social entrepreneur who has pioneered ways to empower citizens to help make a difference. He is the founder and CEO of Be the Change Incorporated, which creates and manages national issue-based campaigns driven by broad cross-sector coalitions. Alan is also the co-founder and former CEO of City Year, which unites young adults ages 17 to 24 from all backgrounds for an intensive year of full-time community service mentoring, tutoring, and educating children. Alan Casey.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's really great for me, as Matt referenced, to be back here. I grew up in New Hampshire. I grew up just 20 minutes up Route 3 in Bedford. And it was here in New Hampshire that I really learned the values of service and civic participation that my parents taught me from growing up here. So my dad, when I was just 10 years old, started bringing me to town meeting at my local public school, the McKelvey School, so I could see the value of local government and citizen democracy in action. My mom was den mother for our local Cub Scout troop. I did my first community service through CYO at the St. Elizabeth Seton Church. And in high school, I started volunteering for presidential candidates as part of our first in the nation, very important presidential primary. And it was then that I really learned how true it was that if you ask a New Hampshire voter what they think of a particular presidential candidate, they'll often answer, "I don't know. I've only met them four or five times." It's true. And that's because we take voting very seriously here in New Hampshire. And I'm proud to say that we rank in the top 10 states in voting participation in the country. And so it's really great for me to come home. And I'm so glad that the commission dedicated a day here. And it's been fabulous seeing the Safe Station program, the Partnership for Successful Living. I have to shout out to Matt. We're so proud of him as a City Year alum who's continued to lead in service. But before we start, I just would like to ask you all a couple of questions. So please stand if you've served in our nation's military. Can we have applause for this? Commissioner, too. Do you have some commissioners? John? Commissioner Joe? Yep. Please stand. Okay. Thank you. Please stand if you have served in local, state, or federal government in any capacity. Please stand if you have served through AmeriCorps, the Peace Corps, or some other full-time civilian service program. Thank you. Finally, please stand if you have done any volunteer work, working in a library or a soup kitchen or with Safe Station or any volunteer work at all. So clearly we're preaching to the choir here tonight. I ask that because that's really the mission of this commission. And I want to start with just sort of giving you we're really excited to engage with you, but we want to start with just giving you an overview of what our commission's about before we open it up for dialogue. So as I learned growing up here in New Hampshire, we really are a nation built on service. It was the citizen soldiers who put down their pitchforks and picked up their muskets that really made our revolution possible. In fact, it's a little known fact that at least half of the Minutemen at Bunker Hill were actually from New Hampshire. De Tocqueville, in his famous book, Democracy in America, when he came here in the 19th century, really studying America, the thing he pointed to that surprised him the most and that he thought was so unique about the American character was our constant ability and interest and capacity to form voluntary associations. When Americans saw a problem, they got together a group of volunteers and said, "We can solve this problem." That's really in our DNA. And in fact, the 19th century saw a surge of major institutions starting with religious roots like the YMCA, the American Red Cross, the United Way, to name a few, that are still with us today. And there are many, many more. It's really part of our character. We might even say that service is a defining quality of our sense of collective responsibility and what it means to be an American. And I'm proud to say that New Hampshire also ranks among the highest states in terms of volunteering. We volunteer here higher than the national average. Service means many things. For sure, it includes the work done by volunteers, but it also includes, as I mentioned, those who serve in the military, people who serve in local, state, and federal government, school teachers, people who do a year of service through programs like AmeriCorps, the Peace Corps. But not just now, but throughout our history, we have had bipartisan presidential leadership calling us to serve, going way back, starting with Theodore Roosevelt. President Hoover used service as a strategy to fight poverty. Matt mentioned the Civilian Conservation Corps, created by Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression. We still benefit from that today. JFK, I love the statue of JFK right out front here, created the Peace Corps. One of our commissioners, Mark Guerin, actually led the Peace Corps. They're right here. Johnson created VISTA. President George H.W. Bush created the first Commission on National Service and the Points of Light Foundation to encourage volunteerism. President George W. Bush, his son, after 9/11, created the USA Freedom Corps and then called on all Americans to dedicate at least 2 years of our lives in volunteer service through the course of our lives. So this has been a bipartisan effort really throughout our history. And this commission is a bipartisan idea. It was created through a great partnership between Senator John McCain and Senator Jack Reed. And in fact, Senator McCain said in creating the commission that it needed to be, quote, a catalyst for an important national conversation on military and public service. He also said that our work comes at a time, again quoting him, when our country's at a crossroads. We must decide how we want to foster a culture of service among American men and women from all walks of life. Senator Reed, his partner in creating this commission, echoed his comments by recently stating, quote, the importance of this commission's work and mission cannot be overstated. We as a government must invest in our public servants. This commission's efforts will develop effective ways to increase participation in military, national, and public service for both men and women, ultimately strengthening our communities and our nation. We are indeed at a crossroads in our nation's history. Millions of American citizens volunteer and engage in service every single day. Yet there's much more we can do, more ways we can encourage participation, more ways to embed service in the very fabric of what it means to be an American. That's what this commission is here to do. Our mandate is broad, it's aspirational, but we believe it can be the foundation for a new movement. We intend our mission is to listen to you all. That's why we're here. To learn from those who served and those who haven't served, and to make recommendations to foster a greater ethos of service so that we can ultimately strengthen the democracy that we all love. As our name suggests, the commission will focus on three broad areas of service. The first is military service. About 1.3 million Americans currently serve on active duty in the military, and another million serve in the reserves and National Guard. This represents just under 1% of our country. Added to this are over 22 million veterans, including 108,000 right here in the state of New Hampshire. Taken together, about 9% of our population today has served our country through the military. But there's a growing disconnect between the general public and our armed forces. As I mentioned, only 1% serve in the military. In 1995, 40% of young people aged 16 to 25 had a parent who'd served in the military. By 2016, that was down to just 16%. And over the last decade, the number of young people even eligible for military service has decreased markedly. Only 29% of young people are even eligible to serve in the military. Next is national service, service in the government, federal, state, local. About 2 million people work in the federal government now. That number has been relatively consistent for 20 years, but as a percentage of the overall population, it's actually gone down significantly. Since World War II, it was about 2.4% of the population served in the federal government. Now it's just over 0.5%. More concerning than that is of those 2 million who work in the federal government, only about 6% of them are under the age of 30. So we have a real challenge of inspiring young people to join federal service. In New Hampshire, here, right here, we have 7,500 people that serve in the federal government. There are also many other people who serve in state and local government. There are over 58,000 people right here in New Hampshire who serve through state and local government. Third part of our mission is public service. This is the 63 million Americans, all of us in this room, who volunteer our time to make a difference. It's people who have signed up for AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps. It's Senior Corps. It's about 75,000 people who are doing a year of full-time service. But even the 63 million Americans is only about 25%. Only one in four of us actually regularly volunteer. So there's clearly more we can do. And the programs, AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, are way below scale. There are many more people, Matt can tell you, who would like to do a year of service but don't have the opportunity because of funding, because of other needs. So we're here to say we have to do better. We've got 325 million people in this country, and part of our mandate is how do we inspire everyone? How do we marshal everyone to want to make a difference by sharing their talents? We have 90 million people under age of 19. I know this because I have my daughter's 15, my son's 9. They've both done community service work. But that is a resource to tap. Even middle school kids, even my 9-year-old does service work. How do we inspire them to want to give more, give back and give more? We have over 48 million people are over age 65. And the folks who are in that sort of baby boom generation are not retiring the way their parents and grandparents did. They're doing encore service. They have incredible skills. We met a bunch of great people today at the Partnership for Successful Living and with the Safe Station program who can continue to contribute and use their experience. How do we inspire them? So we have several focuses. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to focus on two primary areas. The first is an evaluation of the military selective service system. And if there's a continued need for that program in its current form, if there are any changes that should be made, including whether women should now have to register the way men do because the ban on women in combat has been lifted, and whether it should continue or be ended. The selective service system is commonly referred to as the draft, but it's not the draft. In fact, we haven't had a draft in this country since 1973 when it ended. The selective service system is designed to be ready in case the country has a national emergency. To have a draft, Congress would have to pass legislation and the president would have to sign it to reinstitute the draft. But there is a question about just being ready. And so that's one issue we have to look at. The second task that we have is really how do we increase the ethos of service, what we've been talking about. How do we explore ways for people to want to give more through volunteering and through a full-time service experience like through AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps? Congress has asked us to look at that. And we want to hear from people who've served and also people who haven't served. Are there barriers to service? What would it take to enable more people to serve? Or maybe people who feel like we don't need to have an ethic of service. We really want to have an ongoing discussion and debate. So there's 11 of us. Our chair is former Congressman Joe Heck from Nevada, who's also active in the reserves of the military and is a doctor and is providing outstanding leadership. We have two vice chairs, as I mentioned, Mark Guerin, who is director of the Peace Corps and also served as a college president and is now at Harvard at the Kennedy School. Mark is vice chair to oversee national and public service. Then we have a vice chair, Deborah Wada, who was Assistant Secretary of the Army for Manpower Affairs and also worked in a leadership role on Capitol Hill and is really an expert on military service. And then there's the rest of us, all of my esteemed colleagues up here, and it's really been already an incredible experience. Each of us was nominated by a different member of Congress, and President Obama also nominated three of us. It's a bipartisan group. We're not fully representative, as you can see. We don't have any young people on this commission, which is, frankly, in my opinion, an oversight. But because of the way it was established with individual members as opposed to one person putting it together. But we're making a real effort to reach out. We've been to high schools. We're talking with various people in service programs. We're talking to people who haven't. We're trying to reach out to as many different people as we can. And we're traveling the country. That's why we're here, to do that. So this is our third trip. Nashua is part of our third trip. We started in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in February. We went to Colorado last month. We were in Boston and New Hampshire on this visit. We're going to be going to Florida, to Iowa, to Illinois, to Texas, California, and Tennessee, and that's just in the first 9 months. We're going to continue this conversation, and that's why we're here tonight, is really to engage with you. So we are looking at 9 key questions. I'm not going to read them all, but I'll let you just take a look at them. That really comes from the law that created this commission, what we have to report back to Congress, to the President, and most importantly to you all, to the American people, as to what we've learned. We have to release a report in a couple of years, in around March of 2020. We have a small staff that's helping us gather the information who are outstanding, incredibly dedicated public servants, every single one of them. But this is really... this meeting tonight is a very important piece of what we're doing. So we're trying to engage all of you, get your ideas, get your thoughts on the recommendations that we need to make. And so we'd like to hear from you on any of these 9 questions. And also, you can use our social media, hashtag inspiredtoserve.gov. We're taking comments. The actual comments for the Federal Register have been extended, so you can submit comments. You can submit comments through our website. So our vision is every American inspired and eager to serve. That's ultimately what we're trying to accomplish here with this effort. Because after all, we are a nation built on service. So with that, I'd love to open it up. We'd love to hear from anybody who wants to make a comment. We'd like you to try to limit your comments to 2 minutes so that everybody has a chance to participate. We'd love you to respond to any of the questions that we're wrestling with and share whatever perspective you have. We have folks with microphones. If you just raise your hand, one of our great staff will come and give you the mic. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. And if you could also, I'm sorry, can you just say your name? And
yeah, sure. I'll be glad to do that and try to answer the questions. My name is Arnie Alpert. I'm the co-director of the New Hampshire program for the American Friends Service Committee. The American Friends Service Committee was created by volunteers in 1917 when young Quaker men who were conscientious objectors to war wanted to serve civilians who were suffering in Europe because of the devastation caused by war at that time. Later on, as the organization continued its work, it was awarded the Nobel Prize for the voluntary service work which took place with refugees in Europe during the second global conflagration that took place. The work of the American Friends Service Committee in the Appalachians during the Great Depression is credited with inspiring Eleanor Roosevelt and some of the programs like the CCC and other aid programs which took place at that time. And when the Peace Corps was formed in the 1960s, the American Friends Service Committee was considered to be a model for the Peace Corps' work. Now, I need to make it clear that I don't get credit for any of that, right? I wasn't born until 1955, so I was not part of that, but I have been with the organization since 1981, so I know a thing or two. I will say that when I turned 18, I was required to register for the draft. My draft number was 6, but it was at the point where they had actually stopped drafting people. They were still requiring us to register. But then smartly, they agreed to abandon registration after they abandoned the conscription process, and I was never forced to make the decision between whether I was going to serve, whether I was going to be a conscientious objector, or whether I was going to risk going to prison for my refusal to participate in war. The draft started up again in 1980, or conscription, or the selective service system, the conscription system started up again in 1980 following the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. And President Jimmy Carter decided basically as a symbolic act that if 18-year-olds were again required to register, that was somehow going to show the Ruskies that we were tough and that we were willing to risk a war, another global war perhaps, because of our revulsion and rejection of what they had done. And ever since then, ever since 1980 then, our young men, when they turn 18, have basically been pawns in a project of global militarism conducted by our government. There is no draft, there is no conscription, there are no plans on the book, but yet our young people are being conditioned and being required and being compelled generally by the threat to deny them access to funds to go to college in order to compel them to put their names into the federal government's giant database. That's what the selective service system is at this point. In response then to your questions that you have asked us, is the military draft or draft contingency still a necessary component of the U.S. national security? I would say no, but I want to note that we currently, according to an article that I read recently, we have special forces operating in some 137 countries in the world. This is not a peacetime situation we're in right now. This is a nation at war. We have been at war in Afghanistan for longer than we have been at war anywhere else, and I would suggest that for many of our 18-year-olds, it'd probably be rather difficult for them to answer the question of why are we there? Why were we in Niger? Why are we in Yemen? Why are we all over the world in more than half of the world's countries supporting war? So let's answer that question, and let's abolish the need for a draft contingency. It's not where our national security comes from. Are modifications to the Selective Service system needed? I would say yes, let's abolish it. I believe we're spending, now tell me if I'm correct, that we spend about $25 million a year maintaining the Selective Service system. Does that sound right to you?
That's about right.
I bet there's people in this world of national service and local service here in the community that can think of plenty of good applications for where some of that money could go right here in Nashua, perhaps to help address the opioid crisis that we are facing right now. How can the United States increase participation in service? I would suggest, and what are some of the barriers here? I would suggest that we start by ending the war making that's going on. I would suggest that we decouple the notion of service from the war making process. It's fine to say thank you for your service when we meet someone who has served in the military, but how about the service of nurses? How about the service of teachers? How about the service of librarians? How about the service of firefighters and police officers and so many other people who are serving their communities? If we can decouple the notion of service from the process of threatening to kill other people, I think that we will go a long way toward reviving and strengthening that concept. I would also suggest that if we can restore our democracy so that you mentioned, Mr. Commissioner, growing up in a New Hampshire town where people served as volunteers. I live in a little town of Canterbury, all right? We have a town meeting. We have basically the whole town is pretty much run by volunteers. We have a library commission. We have a cemetery commission. We have a conservation commission. We have selectmen. We have planning board members. All these people are essentially serving as volunteers for the community. And I think that's great. And if we can restore a sense of grassroots, small-town democracy in our country so that we're connected to our neighbors, we're connected to our communities, that will take us in the direction that we need to go in. Finally, I know I've used up more than my 2 minutes. Mr. Commissioner, you noted that at the beginning of this nation's history, our farmers put down their pitchforks and picked up their muskets. I want to say that at a time when literally more than 50% of this nation's discretionary spending voted on every year by Congress, more than 50% of every dollar goes to military projects, that we can reduce military spending, use those resources to support our schools, support our libraries. Perhaps we can find ways to house the homeless, and perhaps we won't. It's great to have volunteers, but if we can address the root causes of some of the problems that our volunteers are responding to, we will be going in the right direction. And perhaps, sir, it is time to put down our muskets and pick up our pitchforks once again. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Thank you for your comments. Keep going. Okay. Over here.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Patrick Knowles. I'm from Vermont, but I cannot call myself a Vermonter. I was born in New Hampshire and lived all of 3 days here before going back to Vermont. I'm a 22-year veteran of the U.S. Coast Guard. I had the pleasure and the privilege of doing that. I've been with the Department of Homeland Security now in Vermont for about the last 4 years, so I'm starting off hopefully in my next career. And I also volunteer with the board of directors of the Vermont Federal Executive Association, which is partly why I'm here. There are about 5,000 feds in Vermont, not quite as many as are in New Hampshire. And we have an excellent National Guard, both Army and Air National Guard. I'd like to promote for, I guess I could run through here, the military draft or draft contingency still necessary? The Coast Guard's motto is semper paratus, always ready, so I'm a big fan of being ready, hopefully not needing, but being available if necessary. I'll skip over the other ones a little bit. I would like to promote or advocate for a new combined partnership between the National Guard and Reserves and the federal government. I see a lot of collaboration opportunities without competition there. When our National Guard gets called up to serve the state, it's not taking away from the mission of the federal government, and it's fairly large in a lot of capacities, so the federal government would be able to absorb that loss as necessary. I say a new combined partnership because I don't want to replace any of the hiring authorities that exist. I'd only like to add more. Peace Corps and veterans have a lot of opportunities to apply and get hired into the federal government once they have served. What if, and I think they can find a lot of opportunity, job satisfaction in that public service. Some of us may be born with it. Others of us may grow in and develop within us. What if we could combine those federal, the national service, and the military service, get some jobs that are identified early on? You can get into the federal government, but you have to affiliate with the National Guard or Reserve. The National Guard or Reserve and the federal agencies identify positions that would be of mutual benefit, and it's just another hiring authority to allow us to bring in new people. We could promote both. We might be able to bring in younger folks and really strengthen, I think, both. And like I said before, there's a lot of collaboration and not so much competition. And so I would like to advocate for that. And I would thank you all for coming, and I would invite you to Vermont because we're beautiful too. So, but I'll stop talking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Betsy Hood, and I'm the executive director of the Youth Council. We provide a wide array of at-risk services for youth where law enforcement, substance misuse, education, and mental health all intersect. So I have a few nuggets that I'd like to share with you relative to the questions that you have. First of all, one of our programs is to consequence young people when they're arrested for a first-time offense. Many of the kids that we wind up meeting don't believe anybody needs them, cares about them, and referring them to volunteer at local organizations does a tremendous amount for their self-esteem, to the point that kids will volunteer to complete their contract, but then they'll wind up sticking around much later than that because they realize people look up to them, they're needed, they're part of a team, and that has a really tremendous impact. So I would encourage you to really think about that. The second thing is there's a lot of confusion around the changing marijuana laws. In New Hampshire, it's been decriminalized. In neighboring states, it's been legalized. And that really impacts kids' eligibility for military service. A lot of kids now think it's no big deal to smoke pot, yet what we've learned is when they're talking with recruiters, if they have any kind of drug offense, they're not eligible. So I would encourage you to have some kind of really big, you know, public health outreach campaign that if you're even considering a career in military, don't pick up that first joint or don't use. And I think that may help make more kids eligible. Also, I really think that serving is not always done through altruism. I've met a lot of young people that are finishing college and they are scared. They don't know where they're going. They want a roof over their head. They need a job. It's that whole chicken and egg that you can't get a job till you have experience, but you can't get experience until you're employed. And so there's times people look then for AmeriCorps or VISTA type positions in order to meet that need and to get enough experience they can actually get a paying job or wind up figuring out what they want to focus on in grad school. So if you can really play on that for young people, either between high school and college or getting out of college as a way to loop them in early, I think that would be really important. I think the part that also goes along with that is at my agency, we actually start a master's level full-time therapist at $36,000 a year. Okay, so those young people are coming to us with a boatload of student loans, and while Avista gives a nice educational stipend, it's just not enough of an incentive, in my opinion, for somebody to make $11,000 a year and have to live at home because housing around here is really astronomical. So the scope of people who can actually do that is also very narrow. So I would really encourage you to consider all of those in your future planning. Thank you.
Thank you, Betsy. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Susan Smith. I'm with the Friends Program. I'm here tonight to talk to you, give you a little snapshot about one of the National Service Programs, Senior Corps, and its impact on the state of New Hampshire. And in doing so, I should be addressing question 3, 4, and 5 for you. So New Hampshire is ranked as the third fastest state with a growing older population. And programs that promote healthy aging are very important. Senior Corps programs such as the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program, known as RSVP, Foster Grandparent Program, and Senior Companion Program are key resources for New Hampshire residents that are facing the challenges of aging or disability. We assist organizations, municipalities, and schools to address community needs. All three senior corps programs put the skills and talents of older adults to work solving local problems. Many are involved in evidence-based activities. The time and talent of these volunteers helps build the fabric of their communities. Seniors who volunteer improve their own health and well-being, have decreased mortality, reduced need for social support services, have better health and cognitive outcomes than their non-volunteering peers. Healthier, happier seniors and improved local services benefits everyone in New Hampshire. RSVP volunteers support the most vulnerable people in our communities. They serve children, families, and older adults. An example is Bone Builders, which is a free exercise program that assists seniors in improving strength, flexibility, and social interaction, all which are associated with seniors having increased physical and mental activity, better health, prolonged independence. Increased health and well-being allows our older citizens to remain in their own homes and reduces the need for expensive health care services, which in turn helps reduce the cost of that care for everyone. Caregivers provide door-through-door transportation to medical appointments, grocery shopping, and errands, which reduces isolation, a leading barrier for individuals to remain independent and for families to access appropriate services to keep them healthy. For at-risk children experiencing poverty, drug addiction, mental illness in the family, foster care, an incarcerated parent, these factors have a significant detrimental effect on their social and emotional development. New Hampshire's children experience multiple adverse effects at a higher rate than the national average. Students who do not read at grade level before fourth grade are four times less likely to reach their high school graduation compared to their peers, with an even more pronounced negative effect for the economically disadvantaged. There is compelling evidence that reading, math, and other academic performance measures improve when students work with older adults in stable, long-term tutoring situations. A study done by Johns Hopkins on the impact of the foster grandparent program reports that giving back to your community may slow the aging process in ways that lead to a higher quality of life for older adults. Physical, cognitive, and social activity increased in volunteers, suggesting potential for such volunteer programs to improve health for an aging population, while simultaneously improving educational outcomes for children. This is a win-win for everyone involved. Senior companions make a difference by providing assistance and friendship to adults who have difficulty with daily living tasks, such as shopping or paying bills. Senior companion program helps these adults remain independent in their own homes instead of having to move to more costly institutional care, thus saving untold dollars. Senior companions give families or professional caregivers as much needed time off for their duties, run errands, and provide friendship for their clients. Foster grandparents and senior companion volunteers receive $2.65 an hour. The longevity of these volunteers is incredible, serving 15 more hours week after week, year after year, for that small stipend. The return on investment is huge. Barriers keeping more seniors from serving in the two stipend program is that the $2.65 has not changed in 20 years. And there's a lack of publicity that makes recruitment a challenge. And I'd ask people in this room, how much did you know about these senior corps programs before I spoke? And if you don't know about it, how do we expect others to know about it? All three senior corps programs integrate older adults with people of all ages, abilities, and backgrounds, transmitting knowledge and experience to future generations and reinforcing the value of community. In New Hampshire, just in 2017, Over 284,136 hours were contributed by these volunteers. And the value of those hours for the state of New Hampshire in 1 year is over $7 million. So I ask the commission, please do all you can to support Senior Corps and our very important volunteers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you.
Closer to the screen, being a senior citizen, if you don't mind. My name is Pete Duffy. I'm a retired Army colonel. I used to be the JAG officer for the New Hampshire Army National Guard. 35 years in the military, four active, and the rest in the reserve and guard. Some really good comments here. I think the need for adequate remuneration to compensate people in this and other programs is absolutely essential. When I graduated from law school, I had the chance of going into the JAG Corps. I was in the reserves already, or serving in VISTA in Guam. It was tempting, but the salary the military offered me and the career possibilities totally outweighed that. I don't regret my decision. It's hard to get people to volunteer. For 8 years, I was the parent-teacher-student organization president at Central High School. It's the largest high school in the state. We'd have meetings once a month. It's hard to get people to come out after 7 o'clock to go to a meeting. I don't care what your organization is. It's hard. It's tough to get people shaken from their routine. We all try to do it. It's just very difficult. The military draft, I'd like to read something. President Carter, when he reinstituted the draft in 1980, he said, this is not meant for aggressive purposes. It's meant to deter aggression. At the time, as Arnie pointed out, Russia was being very aggressive in Afghanistan. They eventually left. I wish others had learned that lesson. But they left. It was a failure. The draft is an important set piece for strategic purposes. Having the ability to raise manpower very quickly is a deterrent if we ever are faced with a land battle of a scale of we had World War II. Hopefully we never would be. But it's still a set piece that helps deter. It also should spark the need for public service in this country, and I think that's part of the reason why you're here. The draft could be tweaked. I think to eliminate it would be very foolish. I hearken to the Bible of Joseph advising the Pharaoh, 7 years of feast, 7 years of famine. Things are going really well right now. We have a very low unemployment rate. That's not always going to be the case. We don't know what the world will present for military purposes in the future. We hope it's peace. I think there are some very good opportunities approaching. Peace worldwide. I hope it happens, but it's not going to happen in my lifetime. You're still going to have aggressive forces, and the United States is still going to want to be prepared to deal with them. We have a standing army of, 476,000, National Guard strength of 340,000. That's a lot of people and a lot of money. Our military budget, what is it, $700 billion this year? It's way, way up there. Could we do that more effectively? Absolutely. Being a former Guard person or a reservist, the reserve component has a fully burdened life cycle cost about one-third of that of the active military. Why do we have such a standing army? I think if you have it, you will use it. I think maybe having it probably dictates why we're using it in so many countries. I think Arnie has some really good points. That requires a lot of examination. The CIA has a budget of $60 billion a year. Both have attained sacred cow status. I hope some of you had the opportunity to watch the Looming Tower series based upon a book by Lawrence Wright, a Texas journalist. If you haven't seen it or read the book, I urge you all to do that. The draft. You know, my draft number was 26 when I was a senior in college. Fortunately, I found a reserve unit that enabled me to go to law school. I don't regret going into the military. The Guard is a perfect place to provide community service while serving in the military. It absolutely is. Modifications? I think we do need modifications. Why does somebody like Arnie, a Friends member, have to even sweat out being drafted? Can't we pre-certify some of these people with a draft? So, look, you're not going to go. You're not going to be eligible. It's not a worry for you. But can we use the military to provide more vocational training in this country? Right now, we don't have enough carpenters or plumbers. As Woody Allen says, you think it's hard to talk to Guard, try getting a plumber on Sunday. We don't. I have two carpenters in the house right now. We have a shortage. If the military could provide better vocational training in the trades, we don't have it today. Our folks could leave the military, hit the ground running, go to work. VISTA, it's a great program. We have several opportunities with that program and others. Modifications, I think we could have some tweaking. The Israelis, the last 2 years ago at the Mall of New Hampshire, I met an Israeli woman who was manning a booth for her country, selling a skin lotion, and we started talking about the military. Are you serving? Yes, I am. Really? Yes, I'm a special education teacher, and my job in the military is to provide special ed to my community. Why can't we bring people who are trained in community skills, bring them into the military, and put them to work with what they're already trained to do? The Germans, they hire somebody who's trained as a mechanic to be a military mechanic. Military doesn't pick up the bill for that cost. There are ways we could make the service more attractive to our men and women so they can learn vocational skills. I also was down in Washington for 8 years for the National Guard Association, and I recall vividly a representative from Ohio, Marcy Kaptur. During the years that we had very, very high unemployment with our veterans, she proposed a bill, it died, that would have allowed our veterans to serve in a civilian conservation corps type program in Ohio. Would have been a hit on so many fronts, would have given them work, meaningful work, would also allow them to be with their peers, which has wonderful healing effects for PTSD. Barriers right now to public, military, national public service. I think money is a big one. How can we compensate these people fairly? Can we have student loan forgiveness if they serve in VISTA or one of these other programs? My wife's a teacher. She had a National Defense Education Loan that was forgiven the more she taught. It was terrific. These kids today have a huge burden with the debt they have to pay. We have to figure out a better way to get that burden off their head, which is a psychic killer for them. Service definitely has an inherent value. Everybody in this room recognizes that, otherwise they wouldn't be serving. Mandatory service requirement, don't think you can make it mandatory. I really don't think so. The service has to come from a willingness of a person to own that and to want to do that. But I think there are ways we can encourage that by providing better compensation for programs like VISTA, AmeriCorps, and the military is an opportunity to serve and to learn vocational skills. I think it could greatly improve on both those areas. Increase the propensity, I think it has to be done monetarily. Have loan forgiveness, have better pay for our volunteers. It's just hard to get people to volunteer. Close with this, as an attorney who practiced here for 25 years, we have pro bono programs in the law. It's hard to get our attorneys to do pro bono work. It just is. Each firm, big firm, likes to have a couple out there, decorations, and they do. Currently, I won't close together, right? I have too much words. I do some volunteer work for attorney Larry Fogelman. He practices in Manchester. Larry does vet disability in disability work, and he challenges some of the bad discharge for our veterans. I have one file I picked up for him. Larry has a number of files. He tries to get attorneys to help him out very, very hard. If we had a VISTA program or a federal program that would pay attorneys, paralegals, to assist veterans in contesting their discharges, applying for disability benefits, it'd be terrific. VA means well, but it doesn't fill the bill across the military. If you talk to your Vietnam veterans in Washington, Rick Weidman. Talk to Rick Weidman. Rick will say that it's under 40% of veterans who actually enroll in the VA for services. Why? I don't know. But there are other ways to reach our veterans besides the VA. We need more folks in our communities, lawyers, paralegals, assisting our veterans to put us on the right track. That's enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you. My name is Hope Driscoll, and I'm a returned Peace Corps volunteer. I also directed a National Direct AmeriCorps program, and at the moment I'm on the staff of Volunteer New Hampshire, which is the State Commission on Service and Volunteerism. And I'd just like to second, third, the difficulty and the barrier in terms of the cost of national service. As a Peace Corps volunteer, you have to be able to take 2.5 years out of your life. As a VISTA or AmeriCorps member, you need to be able to have someone else supporting you, unless you're in a part of the country where the stipend is enough to cover your, and there are places in the country where it is. But even though there's a challenge to this, and it would be great if you could get, I like the idea of loan forgiveness for a lot, an awful lot. I think that one of the other ways of encouraging national service and fostering it is really to make it more well known. Peace Corps is probably one of the better known, but I think a strong, robust alumni organization for Peace Corps, VISTA, and AmeriCorps, where AmeriCorps members, VISTA, Peace Corps, go into the schools and talk to students, could go into the community and talk about, you know, where, what they're doing and where they're serving and why they're doing it. Peace Corps, I have to say, I think it's a little bit easier because there's an exotic element to it. So being able to go into a school and talk about Costa Rica, which is where I served, is maybe a little bit easier. But I think that there are ways to just raise the profile of national service. The other thing I'd like to say is that not everybody can do service all the time. And so I think it's important to recognize the volunteer work that people do when they can do it. My guess is a lot more people volunteer than shows up in the studies, and it may not be volunteer every Monday night at the library, but maybe it's shoveling your elderly neighbor's walk. That's volunteering, and I think that that kind of volunteering also has to be given its due to make people, because that service and that grows it, and it's being able to do what people can do when they can do it. So I think if there's it in this, yes, we need the more formal kind of service work, but it's also really important to celebrate the work that the volunteering that people do because they want to do it, and calling that service as well.
Thank you very much, Hope.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Colonel Greg Knight. I'm the Human Resources Officer for the Vermont Army National Guard. As of last week, I was the Chief of Staff for Personnel prior to that, and I've been a recruiting battalion commander. So a lot of what I'll talk about focuses on the military piece, but I think there'll be some bleed over. I hear a lot of great messages here. And coming back to somebody mentioned vocations, Governor Scott just last week came to Camp Johnson and signed the bill specifically allowing for the crosswalk of vocations from military service into civil service. That includes RNs, LPNs, welders, electricians, all those certifications carry forward. So that ties into something that I'd like to see more of. I reach out to my sister states. I'm not reinventing the wheel. So what are you doing that makes a difference, and how did you get it done? And now I can take that. If it worked for you, why would it not work for me? And accordingly, why would it not work for all the rest of us? Barriers. I think what I'm hearing here, and ma'am, your point was valid, I think we do a pretty poor job telling our story. I think we, after 12 years of conflict, we've kind of lost the art of being within our community. I'm speaking on behalf of the National Guard. We've become an operational reserve. That's great. It comes with a lot of benefits, but it's also pulled us away from our communities. This is just Knight's perspective. Telling the story, how many people in here know or heard of the state partnership program? Because everything that we do is not kinetic. We have 74 unique partnerships throughout the globe. And in Vermont, we have a state partnership program with Macedonia. Next year will be 25 years. We were one of the founding programs. And we just celebrated, I just got from back from Senegal 2 weeks ago, celebrating 10 years of a partnership with Senegal. And it starts as a military to military. But 4 years ago, the president of Senegal came to Vermont to meet with the governor. He brought his staff and his business leaders, and they went to the Department of Emergency Management, and now it becomes civilian to civilian, civil service to civil service. So that's foundational for us, and that, to me, is a success. When I look at Senegal, our role in the military, we bring our resources over there to help them build a humanitarian demining center of excellence, and that's from training their instructors, to helping them build the training range, and actually having them do stockpile management. So it's not kinetic. It's not just about killing. It's about helping stabilize a country, and I think it grows regionally, and that's one of the benefits of the program. I think for military service, there's still a stigma. I've seen it as a recruiting commander. It's not universal. Some schools and guidance counselors understand the benefits of for some kids. We don't want everybody. Some people should serve other ways. That's fine. All of my children, I have four kids. They're not all suited to be in the military. It's not for everybody. But I think when I talk to some guidance counselors in the military, it's an option, but it's the last option. What I will tell you, after 35 years of service, that was the best option for me. So as I look around, I think it comes back to telling our story, and as an organization here, start sharing best practices. I don't know how to do that yet. I'm on Facebook, and my daughter's like, oh, my God, Dad, Facebook is for old people. So whatever the mechanism is now, I don't know. I don't know how to best make that message fit, how to develop those themes, but I think we could all do better telling our story. So thank you for making that point.
Thank you, Colonel Knight.
Hi, I'd just like to begin answering your first question so you'll know where I'm coming from, that I definitely think there is no need for a military draft or a contingency or even a selective service that can bother with it. Just so you'll know, I'm not talking off the top of nothing. I've done a lot of service in my life. I've been an elected official in a town. I have gotten a Lifetime Achievement Award for service that I have done. I have done work even with the American Friends Service Committee on a local, state, and national level. So I have done service. I've probably done as much as any of you, but I'm not going to make a list of it. That would waste your time. But I think that, now I've got my little notes. I can't even read them. Okay. One thing the American Friends Service Committee did was what Artie said. They won the Peace Prize because of feeding people in Europe. They were feeding children on both sides. They were not doing things because the United States ordered them to do. They were actually working against something that the United States was doing. They were feeding people that the United States was fighting against. They were doing it because it was a service to both sides, to people who needed it. What during the Japanese, when they were in I can only call them concentration camps, it was the Quakers who went into the camps to help the people there, to give them things. They were the only ones, I understand, from people I know who were in those camps. They weren't doing it because the government ordered them to do it. In fact, the government thought that these people should be locked up. They were doing it because they were giving a service. They were giving it to someone who needed it. And they were giving it, guess what, because they wanted to, because that service was important. You couldn't have set somebody down on the streets and say, oh, it's your turn. Go into the Japanese camps and play bingo with them or something today. You aren't going to do something like that. It's not service if it's something that you're told you have to do. All of these wonderful programs they've been talking at here, they all are programs. The people do them. They're not just upping and doing them all on their own. They're in these various programs that say, oh, this is a service you can do. Oh, go feed these people. I was in charge of a program that did feed people. Every week we fed people. Nobody told us we had to do it. We did it because we wanted to. And that's what service is all about. It's doing things because you wanted to. Now, one of my services has been 27 years of working in a prison, both in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire. Even in New Hampshire, you do have prisons, I have to say. We in Massachusetts can't take credit for all of that. And one of the things about the military service is we see a lot of people in prison, and this worries us not just because being in prison is very, very, very expensive. We see a lot of people who are in prison because of things they do because they were suffering from things they were made to do when they were in the military. They were not enlistees, most of them. They were people who were drafted. They were told they had to go in the military. They were told they had to go and shoot people. You know, oh, I'm learning how to shoot a dummy, no. But someday it's going to be a real person. They really are suffering from that. They suffer a lot, and they make the community suffer, their families suffer, and eventually an awful lot end up in prison. And we don't even see the worst of them, because the ones that come to our program are probably the ones that volunteer to come to our program to help make themselves better, and they appreciate what we do to make themselves better. And that's, nobody told me to go into prison. They all say, how come you people come into prison and it's, you know, 3 hours every week to go into the prison? Well, because somebody has needed to do that. And we decided on our own that somebody needed to do it, and we do it. And Arnie mentioned the volunteers from Massachusetts, and there were wonderful volunteers from Massachusetts, from New Hampshire, excuse me. The volunteers from New Hampshire who went off and put down their shovels and fought in the Revolutionary War. But, of course, I have to take Massachusetts credit and said it was Patriots Day that was the first thing. And all the people who did that, they were told the British were coming, and they rushed out and started shooting because they felt it was needed. They felt it was needed that they be free. And I bet if you had, we're thinking of having a war. If it was something that people really believed in, if they really believed that it was nothing that could be solved by peaceful methods, which I think seldom happens myself, but that's personal. But if there was nothing that could be done by peaceful methods and they felt that the war was needed, they would volunteer, just like they did, just like the Patriots did. But they would do it because it was something they felt was needed. So, you know, in the Vietnam War, people didn't want to go and shoot all those little yellow people or whatever they were. They went because they were drafted. There's no need for a draft. If you needed people to serve in any way at all, you know, they would come up if they felt it was needed. And a lot of the people in New Hampshire and elsewhere that are in the military right now and that did enlist did so because there are no jobs. They really could not find anything else to do. And they get out, and they don't want to, even when they're in the military. They can be looked at if they speak against it and say, oh, well, this is just a job. They can be regarded as being a wimp, and even worse, they can be regarded as being unpatriotic. And they're not unpatriotic. They are very supportive of the USA, but not necessarily of what we're doing there or what they're going to have to do. But they have to do it because there are no jobs. And if a lot of this money that's now spent on the military was spent on education, which everybody was saying, we need education, that would be a better thing than having something to do with no volunteerism. You're going to get volunteers. People will volunteer. Whether they get a chance through some program that has been made by somebody else, they're not necessarily mandated to go into that. I mean, you can even say you're not going to do something when your parents tell you to do it. It does happen, and you don't die out of it. Really, you don't. But, that's what happens. And so that's what you have to do. And you really do not need the military, and you certainly do not need to enlist people, or you don't need to draft people or have anything to draft people. If you had a war and you called for people who thought it was a bad thing to do, they thought they needed to fight, they would enlist. You would have all the ones you needed. You do not need a draft. You do not need a selective service. It's just another way of spending a lot of money you don't need to spend. You know, we need lots of money in the government. We're way out of money that we need for good programs. You can save that money on the selective service. You can save the money that you spend on all of this and just eliminate it.
Thank you.
My name is Edward Hasbrook, a native New Englander, but here by way of San Francisco, where I live now, and you're probably tired of hearing from me. But after I told a bit of my story to you last night in Boston, I was talking with some of your excellent staff and made some suggestions, and they said, well, those are things that are up to the commission. You should tell those to the commission. So with that invitation, you know, I commend you, and I really appreciate the effort that you are making to have this kind of dialogue about voluntary service. I hope that you will make an effort, equal effort, and I think you could, to try to address the other half of your bifurcated assignment, which is to look at compulsory service. And, you know, I was told by the staff that you're getting some comments about the draft in the written comments. Well, because it's at least a little bit laid out on your website that that's part of the agenda when people are submitting written comments. But I have here, you know, flyers that were posted on your website and went up for the five public events that have been advertised, including one next week in Jacksonville. There is not one word on these about selective service, draft, compulsory service. Not one word. Not mentioned that it's on the agenda. You have a website at inspiretoserve.gov. That's great for volunteerism. You don't have a parallel website that goes to the same place or to a parallel place that says compeltoserve.gov or coercetoserve.gov. How are people even going to know that that's the agenda if you don't advertise and promote these events? And it's really clear that this is advertised and promoted only on one side. And you've had five events or have advertised five events. Your panels have all been about voluntary service, not one panelist talking about compulsory service. So if you really want to have a dialogue about that other part of what you got to report to Congress on, please make at least several of your upcoming sessions equally focused and advertised as being on that. You're supposed to report on whether women should be added to the selective service system. Go to a women's college. Go to Wellesley. Go to Mills College. Have an event on a women's college campus where the specific focus is, should women be required to register with the selective service? You're supposed to report on whether healthcare workers, people with language, STEM, et cetera, skills should be drafted. You're going to Chicago, probably because you're going to the Great Lakes Naval Training Center to get a great look at the selective service useless database of obsolete addresses of where people live when they were 18 years old. It would be no good to draft them. But you're going to Chicago. Go to my alma mater, the University of Chicago. They'd love to have you. Specifically invite the medical and nursing students and the technicians from the hospitals and the people in the language departments and the computer science and mathematics and other people learning STEM skills. Invite folks from the AMA, headquarters just a couple blocks away. Advertise that in advance specifically as a forum to focus on whether people in those specialties should be conscripted to compulsory service. You're going to California, where I live now. That's a great place to talk about why people choose not to serve in the military. Because California doesn't require you to register for the draft in order to get a driver's license, and we have a very strong civic culture at the moment in California against having state resources be commandeered to enforce federal requirements we don't like. So I don't think that's changing in California. We have some of the lowest compliance with selective service in California, and there's been a strong tradition of draft resistance in California. You want to know why some people serve and some people don't when it comes to compulsory service? I challenge you to come and make your California forum specifically on that question and invite somebody who served in the military, who was drafted into the military and served as a draftee, and somebody who refused induction, somebody who registered for the draft and somebody like me who refused to register for the draft. If you don't ask those, and advertise those well in advance that those are going to be the focus for those sessions, the same way you advertise that, whether to volunteer, to be inspired to service as opposed to being commanded to serve, which is part of your charter, was the focus for this session, and have appropriate panels to speak to those questions of compulsory service, pro and con, at your future events. And I'd love to, you know, I've written and published on some of this. I'd love to be part of that, help you find people who can articulate the case for why people do not want to be compelled to serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments that anybody wants to share? All right. Well, with that, we come to the conclusion. I want to thank you again for giving up some of your evening, and for all of you, your own commitment to voluntary service. I want to thank our panelists, our speakers, who have shared their stories. And if you have further ideas that come to you after this, please use our website. We're getting comments. We want to hear from you. And for those of you who know people who are interested in this but couldn't come tonight, please share with them what we discussed tonight. Also, that our website is available. We want to hear from people. We really are looking at this as a two-year conversation with the American public so that we can come up with the best recommendations possible for the Congress, the President, and the American people. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.